All right, looks like most people found their rooms. I guess we'll get started here. I'm Brian Binkowski. I'm with Environmental Health News and the Daily Climate. And I'll let everybody else say where they're from. We have a pretty good panel here. I'm excited to have them. So if you guys just want to say where you're right and your name, it'd be great.
My name is Sarah Martek. I work with an environmental justice nonprofit called the Center for Coalfield Justice.
My name is Talia Buford. I am a reporter at ProPublica.
You guys want to go this way? Sorry.
You can't talk. Do you want
to? Yeah. We can play in the neighbors.
I'm Nikhil Swaminathan. I am a senior editor at Grist, and I lead our environmental justice coverage.
My name is Yesenia Funes, and I will be covering environmental justice for Earther, Gizmodo's new environmental website.
Cool. So this panel is about finding sources for environmental justice stories, which everybody up here and out there can attest is difficult. There's some certain complexities to these stories, and we're here to try to help you navigate that a bit. So we'll get into finding sources to find the story ideas, but I wanted to start talking about once you've identified a community that's an EJ community, kind of where you guys try to get your foot in the door. To gain the trust of those communities, to actually get on the ground and talk to them, and what that looks like. So whoever wants to start.
I guess where I usually start is...
Get a little closer.
Where I usually start is looking for community organizations that are already... sort of active in the community. I'm sure if I were reporting on Washington County, I would look for someone like Sarah as kind of an ambassador to get me in the door. I think that especially when you're reporting about a community that you are not familiar with, you need to get kind of your legs under you and like have a sense of what's going on the ground and sort of the forces that are at play, and you need somebody to sort of open some doors for you. At Grist, our major concern is finding community members who can tell their stories, and so an organization, for instance, like Sarah's would be our like first point of entry, but then we would be looking for sort of the people that they organize to like sort of tell their own stories. So that's sort of the first thing that jumps to mind.
Yeah. So what I usually do is I definitely do that, obviously. Like I usually it's almost like I guess like a game of Plinko or whatever. And so it's like I start at wherever organization is doing work on the actual issue, and usually they have someone, maybe it's like Sierra Club or NRDC, and they're at national level, and then they're working with people like, you know, Coalfield Justice or someone local at the level. And I'm like, okay, well, connect me with these people, and then they can say, okay, well, I have this person or I know this other organization. It's really just like almost like not a game of telephone, but it's just like, okay, who do you know? Who can I talk to? Who else should I be talking to? I also will do clip searches and just kind of like look at public hearings, look and see who's been testifying, look and see who's been writing comments. I did a mass mailing the other day because it was like I was doing a story on a rule, and I'm like, I'm not sure if anybody is doing anything, but I know that people commented, so let me just send them all letters, and hopefully someone will, you know, get back to me. And so sometimes it's, kind of blanketing the area and doing a lot of the like really groundworky sort of journalism that it's a little bit more difficult and not as quick of a return, but sometimes people do call you back, or you'll find some organization or some person, and then also you if you can, which is not always possible, you go actually to the community. That's obviously ideal. I think that's what everyone here would say, is if you can get to the community, you just go. You go to the hearings, you go knock on doors, and you know, then it's much easier to facilitate sort of those connections. But from afar, at least to start, you kind of go with the organizations, you go with, you know, the clip searches, and trying to like say, okay, well, this person talked about this in, you know, the Pittsburgh paper, and so, well, let me see if I can find this person, and maybe they know someone, and maybe they know someone. And so it's just kind of a lot of that not blind searching. I feel like I'm using a lot of metaphors here. A lot of throwing things out and seeing what sticks.
Sarah, I think there's probably lessons. You're in a rural area, from what I saw,
yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's lessons as an organizer that you would recommend to journalists, because you guys probably went there. A lot of people maybe weren't even aware of the issue itself.
Yeah. So, do you mean the kind of like best practices, kind of?
Best practices and just kind of getting your word out in a place where maybe there isn't these information hubs, like a city center or something. I mean, you're in a place where people are a little more spread out.
Yeah, so you were saying a lot about, you know, being direct, knocking on doors, that kind of thing. That's really important. Environmental justice as a term in rural communities is not necessarily something that you're going to hear or have people discuss. They just live it. So if you describe kind of the situations, they're like, yes, I live in an environmental justice community. Like, these are issues that we're facing. It's really important when you are going in for a story to make sure that you develop a relationship with these people, because while you're looking for a story, this is their life. You know, people in the community that I'm working with, there's a family I was just at on their property the other day. They have been trying to get water to a pasture where they keep their horses for 7 years. This has been a 7-year legal battle. So they don't trust many people, but making sure that you tell the story honestly, things like that, that's really important to them, to again, build these relationships and not let it drop.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, please, yeah.
I think that Sarah made a wonderful point. Like, once you establish these sources, you have to hold on to them and continue relationships with them, even if it's just like checking in once a month, like, how's it going? What's going on? Is there anything new going on in the community that should be on my radar that's not on my radar? I know for me, like, once I've built, I cover EJ nationally, so there's sources in all these different parts of the country that I can't go to, that I haven't been to. But we develop, you know, almost friendly relationships at some point, and following them on Facebook, I find out a lot of stories just from like their posts of their, you know, they're pissed off about something or they're sharing a story. And I'm like the Energy East pipeline in Canada got canceled, and I found that out through a source sharing that on Facebook. I mean, I would have found it out either way, but I found that out much quicker because they posted it on Facebook. So it's important to just build those relationships and hold on to those people too, because they'll be valuable for you and they want to keep talking to you.
Tilia had a good, I reached out to everybody before the panel and asked them, what did I miss in the questions? And this was maybe my favorite one, is how to report and engage with these communities and not show pity, show empathy, but not pity. And I'm wondering, Tilia or anybody, how you go about handling that.
I'll kind of give a little bit more background on that. So I'm from Flint. And I mentioned this in a panel yesterday. And so when people hear that I'm from Flint, usually their faces kind of drop a little bit and their voice gets very saccharine. And I don't even live in the city anymore. And I'm like, okay, if you're speaking to me in that way, I can't imagine how you're interacting with people who are actually in the community having to live with this every day. and so I think, I don't know, it's difficult, but it's also not. It's like, just be a human. Like, don't put on, don't be fake, don't pretend. Like, it's very it's okay to say, you know what, that is horrible and I'm sorry you have to go through this, without making them feel like they're less than, or that there's something, you know, wrong with them, or they're contaminated because of whatever situation that they're living in. And I think it's really just a matter of listening to them and kind of just being present with them. And because when you're putting on that sort of affect where you're being very sympathetic or whatever, that's more for you. And you want to show that you are paying attention to them and like, look, I feel sorry for you. And it's like, well, maybe that's not what they need. Maybe they just need someone to listen to you, listen to them. Or maybe they just need, mostly they just need someone to listen to them. And so do that. And as opposed to what you think that they want, like actually listen to what they actually might need. And Sarah might have...
Yeah, so as opposed to like coming in with an idea for a story, like you might read you might read something that prompts an idea for a story for you, but when you go to the community, the way that the community is responding to whatever's happening could be completely different than what you anticipated it being. So allow them to tell their stories in an organic way and then report it the way that it's told. That really is helpful.
Yeah, I just want to add something. I think it's really important sometimes, if you have the time, and oftentimes we don't, to just put your notebook down for a little bit and put your camera away and not show up places and put your camera right in people's faces. It's not about letting them put their guard down or anything. It's just a comfort thing, and maybe just hang out with people and listen a bit. But did you guys have something to add?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to add to that, and that's just... There's a central tension when you're working on environmental justice stories, and it's a tension between the business that we're in of, like, trying to produce stories and the fact that, like, if you report on this the way that Talia and Sarah and Brian were talking about, which is the correct way to do it, frankly, is these stories take time, and you have to develop your rapport with your sources. And, you know, one thing that I do is I'll usually, like, write out sort of questions that I want to ask before I go into an interview. But it's going to take me, like, literally at least an hour to get through all of those questions because, if not more, because, and sometimes I'll even decide to come back and ask them as, like, follow-up because... What you're trying to do is you're trying to engage at, like, a human level and not as a reporter being like, okay, tell me, like, what's in your taps? Like, what happened? Like, do you have any medical records? Like, there's a wrong way to do this. And I just think you have to, like, interact as a human for a minute, or not a minute, for a much longer than a minute.
Just 60 seconds. That's it.
And sort of, like, realize that what you're going into a lot of times when you're talking to these communities is, like, part reporting, part therapy session, part, you know, just dialogue.
Yeah. Just kind of to go off that, like, instead of thinking about people as, like, sources and, like, you know, some sort of a commodity, think about it like, okay, if I'm talking to my mom about this situation, like, how would I just sit there and say, okay, mom, so, you know, what do you need? I need to get these things checked off. You say, okay, well, what's going on? You know, and how, what's going on? What do you do with your water? Like, wait, what happens to this? And that's crazy. What do you mean? And so it's basically just talking to them in the same way that you would want to be spoken to, essentially, and the way that you would talk to someone that you care about. Because I think that's one of the things, especially in these communities that we cover, they haven't usually had that shown to someone who is a reporter or from a reporter or from someone who is maybe in authority or whatever. And that's partially why they're in this situation, because they haven't been listened to. And it's like, one, give them that respect, listen to them, and speak to them like human beings.
Specifically for toxic stories and coal plants and health impacts, one thing that I've run into, and I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on this, is people saying, oh my goodness, there's so much cancer in this community, I can't breathe, you know, and a lot of times there just isn't the epidemiology to support that. So I'm wondering, from a sourcing perspective, where do you guys go to kind of have this factual, accurate backbone while still giving credence to these very real human concerns?
Sure.
I wrote a story earlier this year about the Moapa Band of Paiutes in Nevada, and they're this very small, no more than like 200 members of a tribe, and they're literally too small to have a study conducted that tells a factual story, which is, you know, a major bummer for them because they can't prove that these health impacts like cancer and respiratory illnesses from a coal generating station that has been in their community for decades that they finally shut down is impacting them. And I had a lot of trouble with that. It's like, how do I write about this if there is no research that I can turn to? But, you know, I'm big on anecdotes and finding researchers that can explain the health impacts generally. They were lucky enough that they had a researcher come in and try to conduct a study, so he can speak to, you know, the fact that his research said a lot, but as a scientist, it couldn't be conclusive. And you have to be just transparent about that in your story. Like, they're too small to have this kind of study made, and but this is what's happening. Have someone say in the story, and they're going to tell you this. I know five people on my block that have cancer, and that's real, regardless of whatever is causing it. And that's a part of their experience, and, you know, people can be skeptical if they choose to, but you have to be able to tell their truth.
I think definitely you acknowledge that, like you said, you acknowledge that, you know, hey, it's really tough to tie a lot of this stuff to very conclusive, you know, scientific conclusions, but there is value in people's stories. And there's value in giving credence to what people are telling you is going on. I think also you can find, just like Yesenia said, you can find experts who maybe have done studies on it, but you can also find people who are like experts in the community. So there may be scientists in the community. There may be, I know I did a story on pesticides in California where it's like everyone kind of assumes that there's something, you know, that the health effects that were caused by some of the pesticides, but there was nothing necessarily definitive about it. And so I went and I talked to a local, like a community health provider. And I said, well, what do you see in this community? Like, what are the health effects that you do see? And whether or not you can tie them to, you know, this particular pesticide, what I can say is that this community is overburdened by asthma and overburdened by, you know, these kinds of cancers. And maybe I can't draw a direct line, but I can put the facts on the table and try to at least trust the reader enough to say, you know what, maybe even if we haven't studied this enough, there might be something here that, you know, maybe further down the line when we have better science, or when we have more information, or when we actually just pay attention and study these things, this might be a clue along the way. So,
please.
And I think kind of part of our job as journalists is laying the facts out there with the hope that someone is going to be paying attention and taking action following that. So if there haven't been studies, and there can be, yeah, you know, at some point someone's going to hopefully see your article and think, oh, shit, there should be a study done on this, and I'm a researcher, and I can do this study, and hopefully it's someone from the community. But regardless, the fact that someone would be able to see your work and feel inspired to conduct a study is important, I think.
No, I'm sorry. I'm so hyper-focused on these folks. What's going on?
Can I just add something to the previous thing?
And then sure.
That's like,
sure.
I know that was like in one of your questions.
Sure.
Anyway, so
yeah.
I guess we're getting there. But
I just wanted to answer the previous question as an editor, because it's sort of my job to stress test things that people like Yesenia or Talia bring to a publication, the reporting that they've gone and collected. And so hopefully, like, you're asking a lot of questions, you're interrogating everything they found. Okay, this community health person says X, Y, and Z, you know, there's all these anecdotes about asthma rates, et cetera, et cetera. Just really quickly, and actually Talia mentioned this in an email conversation I had with her a few weeks ago, so it's fresh in my mind, but if you read that Sarah Maslin Neer piece that was in the New York Times on nail salon workers, the second story, which is like the EJ story, she doesn't have any definitive evidence specifically of like what's happening to the nail salon workers that she's profiling, but she does like 200 interviews. She like talks to a local doctor in New York. She talks to a community group in California that has done some, you know, work on the chemicals that nail salon workers are exposed to. I mean, by the end of it, there's no direct like smoking gun, but she's amassed so much evidence that the, you know, the case is like sort of overwhelming. And as a journalist, you know, sometimes you sort of have to lean on those types of legal arguments where somebody is able to bring enough information to bear that it's convincing to you as an editor and obviously hopefully to readers as well.
Yeah, and real quick before your question, to piggyback on that, what we try to do in our stories is, because you always run into this, you can't, like smoke, we don't know smoking causes lung cancer definitively, right? So, you know, creating a community profile I think is really helpful too. So even if they're complaining about respiratory impacts and they're in the shadow of a coal plant, pointing out that there's probably inadequate healthcare facilities in a lot of these communities, the median household income is probably very low, you know, diabetes rates might be elevated. And again, all of these, they don't operate in a vacuum, right? You're creating a community profile, and I think that's really helpful on a lot of these stories. And the CDC data and things like that are really helpful to make it more robust. So I'm going to have you ask that again so I can say it, because I was told to do that. So. No, now's good, man.
Yeah. My question is, you were commenting on the fact that hopefully the story that you would produce would affect change in those communities and alleviate some of the problems that they're facing. How do you avoid the pitfalls of that promise?
So how do you tell the story of a community without making any promises that the story will have any designated impact? So.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem that we at CCJ try to monitor a little bit. So if you would approach us and say that I want to write the story, there would be a pretty decent process with us saying, you know, kind of getting, where are you going with the story? What kinds of things are you trying to tell? What's the story? Because, like you said, you pointed out, people do get tired of it. They've had to tell, you know, a lot of times they have to tell their stories to reporter after reporter. They go to their politicians at the local level, at the state level, sometimes at the national level, and they're just tired of it. Talking about some of the best practices that we've done before, where you don't let a story drop, is very helpful. So even if you can't, if your story fosters some kind of sense of this could change, hopefully this will help. Not letting it drop and saying, we're working on it, we're going to keep publishing the story and pushing it out and finding new interesting angles that might catch someone and their attention or change their hearts and minds a little bit, you know, from a different perspective, that's important. So for example, a lot of people in Greene County, one of the counties we work in, they're a very red area, and very, a lot of people are very pro-coal, except for there's also the issue of property rights. So if you own property and your land was, you had land subsidence because of the mining, now you can't resell your property. So kind of telling different angles with the same issue can be helpful, because then you get different responses from different people. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
I think, it's definitely tough when you're dealing with people who have been talking to the media over and over and over again. And I think as a journalist, you have to ask yourself, there are other people who probably haven't been spoken to that would be dying to tell their story. And am I speaking to the right people if they're feeling that way? But in my experience, I feel like, you know, people aren't naive. These communities have gone through so much already on top of the environmental injustices that they face, be it racism, systemic racism, sexism, if they're women, that they don't have, I don't think that they would have expectations from us. I've always gotten a sense that, you know, someone will tell me, I'm just telling you my story, and like, I don't know if this is going to do anything, but thanks for listening to me. So I've never really felt that they get a false sense of hope. I probably get more hopeful than they do, because they've been, you know, and they know already. They know the situation, and they know not to have those hopes, because it's not good for them to be falsely hoping for something. But I get the sense they're always thankful to tell me their stories, and I hope that continues being the situation for me at least.
Yeah, just sort of expanding on what Yesenia said. If you're a young reporter in this room, don't make that promise. Yeah. That just don't. Like, you don't know, and you certainly cannot control anything on the Wild West that is the internet. So all you can do is say something important is happening in your community, and I want to tell that story. You can't make any guarantees about where it's going to go. There is this amazing EJ leader in Oakland named Margaret Gordon, who I've talked to several times over the last year or two, and she calls it liberation. She says, like, and she talks about it both in terms of when groups like the Environmental Defense Fund comes to, like, do some, to help researchers do studies in her community, or when reporters report on her community, and lots of them have, because earlier this year they filed a civil rights complaint against the city of Oakland and the port of Oakland, so they have been very active for, like, at least a couple decades. And she says, like, what kind of liberation is this going to bring my community and me being the, like, 700, you know, 32nd reporter who got to her in the last 20 years? Part of what you realize is that she's just hoping. She's trying to tell her story to whoever she can and hope that that's the story that sort of breaks. And so there's a little bit of that involved here, too. And obviously, like, when it comes to a group like Center for Coalfield Justice, for instance, is a really good check for a reporter, because they can tell you, you know, like, if you call, like, somebody who's in Sarah's position, she can be like, this isn't the time for this story. Like, these guys are tired. Like, leave them alone.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's also part of it. There's, like, there's a timing element in all of this, too.
I'm reminded, I was in New York City this year for a talk at Hunter College, and this guy, Gary Young from The Guardian, had this quote. I just love it. He said, we've all heard the, it's not a story if a dog bites man, man bites dog, it's a story. And he was talking about social justice, not environmental justice, but he said, but when the dog keeps biting the man over and over, we got to figure out what the hell's wrong with that dog. And we're doing stories in Eastern North Carolina this year, and that story's been written about those hog farms. But part of the story is the fact that nothing's changed, you know. And Talia did some reporting on the civil rights office, I think it was in 2015, and it's like, if nothing happens, that's a follow-up story. Why is nothing changing? So that's a good question. So the flip side of this is that the bad guys, the industry, or whomever's wronging the community, the zoning laws, whatever it is. If we could talk a little bit about that can be just as challenging sometimes, how you guys get those folks to talk to you, especially when they know you're coming at this as an environmental reporter.
I think sometimes, I feel like it's been said in a few panels, you'll be surprised at what people will actually say to you, and if the people you think don't want to talk to you will be the ones who actually do want to talk to you. So I know that I was doing a story about the Title VI story about civil rights claims, and I had to talk to all of these state DEPs and, you know, environmental regulators, and I'm like, oh, they're going to not want to talk to me at all, because I'm going to basically say, hey, you know, you're basically violating people's civil rights, and don't you want to tell me about, you know, your lives? And when I got to them finally, I'm like, hey, look, you know, I'm writing this story. It's actually what I did is I framed it like, hey, I'm actually writing a story about how bad the federal government is. Don't you want to tell me about, you know, kind of your side of things? And to my surprise, they did. And there was one guy in New Mexico. He sat with me for like 2.5 hours. Like, he showed me all the files. He's like, well, here's what we've done. And I'm just like, great, thank you. Let me get a copy of that.
On the record.
On the record. Yeah, and I had talked to them before, and I said, hey, and I spoke to them several times, and I said, you know, this is what I'm doing, and I talked to their press people, and I said, I want to talk to someone who actually was working on this project and was doing this thing, and they were great, and he was like one of the few people who had been there since, like, you know, this complaint had been filed in the early 90s, and he was just really candid. He was like, they're not doing anything, so we just kind of moved on without it, and now we translate everything. So, I mean, it's part of it is, they think they're doing a lot better job than they probably are, which is fine. And I say that. And, you know, but I'm also able to kind of point out that, you know, they didn't think to translate anything into Spanish until they had a civil rights claim. You know, and it's just like, you live in New Mexico. Like, really? That's what you thought. So that's one thing. Just one, ask them, keep going back to them. A lot of industry or regulators will try and give you a statement. And say, hey, well, isn't this stuff? And it's like, of course it's not. I don't understand half the things in the statement. So, you know, I will go back and say, hey, this is great. I would really like to talk to someone, you know, maybe this person, and just keep going, keep bugging them, basically. The same thing that they tell you in journalism school, just keep bugging them. And sometimes they will break and they'll say, okay, fine, I will get someone to you. And sometimes they won't, but at least you try and get that person. And usually if you can get them on the phone or in the room, you can actually get them to say real words to you as opposed to, you know, the jargon and horrible things that they put in statements. So
the other thing is the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest reporting tool that exists right now is a LinkedIn premium membership. So you can always find somebody who used to work at that company or used to be part of that state or federal agency. At the relevant time, and, you know, internet stalk them. So that's a way to get that side of the story. And, you know, a lot of times you are just going to end up with that canned statement, but you need to do enough to make yourself feel like you tried to die.
Yeah. And just on LinkedIn, I don't know if you guys use LinkedIn Premium, but if you don't, they have these trainings where if you go through the training as a journalist, you can get a free premium membership. And then you can send, like, unlimited messages to people, and you get to see all these different things or whatever. So it's a really, really great tool. Like, we have, like, the LinkedIn recruiter thing and everything. Yeah. So it's, like, you can use all the things. So definitely look into that. It's, like, LinkedIn for Journalists is the group on LinkedIn, and they do trainings, like, once a month or whatever. So.
Yeah.
Please.
I've pretty much always had industry executives like refuse to speak to me because I've written primarily for like small nonprofit media groups, and they don't recognize the name, so they have zero interest in speaking to me. And I'm a big fan of when you're writing the piece and you have to use one of those like BS sentences from their statement writing, they refuse to speak to me, and giving them a little shame for not giving you the time that as a journalist, you deserve. So always remember that too. You can always drop that little line in your sentence that in your story that they forgot or refused to speak to you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That was talked about in yesterday's opening plenary about just being super transparent, you know, writing right in the story. I showed up at the mine and they didn't want to talk to me. You know, that tells a story in itself. I wanted to get to this question before we get to some questions from you all, hopefully, that Yesenia had. The best questions on here came from them, not from me. She asked, you know, whether we as reporters approach our sources differently depending on race, and how we make sure to raise questions about race in our stories. You know, a lot of EJ stories do have a racial component. So Yesenia or whomever, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
When I cover environmental justice, race is usually the biggest component for me. And, you know, as a reporter, I also think that you have to be mindful of your race. And I'm Latina, but every time I go into a story and I'm speaking to someone, be it, you know, like if they're Hispanic or if they're white or if they're black or indigenous, I personally make a concerted effort to bring that into the conversation. How do you think your race impacts your situation? Have you felt discriminated against because of your race? And I'll be explicit, like, I'm Latina, I haven't lived your experience, tell me about that. Or if they're white, you know, like, how do you think that your situation as a white person might be impacting this as well? Especially when you're writing the story, I think that it's important to to be explicit about it, but also tread it carefully, because, I mean, race isn't everything, but it's a major component of the systemic ways that people end up in these situations. And getting into that historically in your story is also super, super important. I was on a panel yesterday with Jenny Monet, who's written some incredible stories about Standing Rock and Native rights issues. And if you're writing a story about a certain demographic and you're not laying out the systemic historical ways that they have been put into these situations, which has been very intentional for, you know, most people of color, then you're not doing your job. Because as reporters, we have to make sure that we lay it all out on the table, because some of our readers won't know that unless, you know, they've studied like racial injustice or something and are well read. But and I don't think it should be something that we're uncomfortable with doing. I imagine the situation is going to be different for any of us. We're all different colors up here, so really excited to hear what y'all think.
I don't know if this is addressing the question, but I know that I sometimes use my race in reporting, in reporting, when I'm talking to people. It's very clear that I'm Black. So when I was reporting in Rhode Island, I would come in and I would talk to people, and I covered a rural part of Rhode Island, which there are rural parts of Rhode Island. I would just say, look, I'm not from here. I'm not a Rhode Islander. And I would just kind of acknowledge that, look, I am different. Let's talk about what I don't know. Help me to understand what it's like for you living here, and help me to understand it enough so that I can tell my readers what it's like, so that they can hear your story. Actually, I think that once you, and I think that that is probably most analogous for most people in this room, because it's not necessarily super colorful in here. And so, you know, like, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be going to these communities where you are the other, and you need to say, look, I don't know. Help me to understand. And listen when they tell you. If you do happen to go into a community where you are a member of the same racial minority or racial background or whatever, or, you know, geographic background or whatever it may be, feel free to use that. So I was talking to a guy from Memphis the other day, and I asked him where he was from, and he said, oh, I'm from New Albany, Mississippi. And I was like, yo, my family's from Oxford, Mississippi. And we started talking about, like, northern Mississippi. And we were on the phone, and one, I knew that he then knew that I was Black on the phone, and his guard went down a little bit. I was no longer just kind of a disembodied voice. I was somebody who he might be my cousin, possibly. I don't know. Like, it turned out to be like, I was like, no, my family, this is our last name. He's like, well, that's my wife's last name. And I'm like, whoa, this actually might be crazy. But, you know, and so it may be that, you know, oh, I grew up on a farm too. Or, you know what? Oh, my family is Irish as well. Or my family is whatever. And you can have those kind of commonalities. And it may not necessarily be based around race. It could be around anything. Just finding a way to make a connection with someone so that they remember that you are a person, one, and that you're there to listen to them. And that you're there not just to make a transaction and for it to be like, I'm going to take something from you. So.
Yeah, I think that it's very, very hard to report on EJ without respecting the race dynamics that are on the ground everywhere that you are reporting. I'm in a particularly unique situation where I am almost never have anything racially in common with the people that I'm reporting on, because statistically there just aren't that many, like, you know, Indian people of Indian descent in the U.S. relative to other communities. But and I used to write about neuroscience, so I used to interview a lot of Indian people, but now I don't. So I usually come at it, though, first from a health perspective, because that's usually in a public health perspective, in part because I grew up in a public health household. Like, my dad worked at the CDC for 30 years. And so the first thing I'm always trying to sort of get a handle on is, like, the community health aspect. Like, what are the exposures? Like, what are the experiences? And then you have to, like, realize that there are like usually structural elements underlying a lot of what you're reporting on. And if you're naive to those, you're going to miss the entire story. So when Yesenia talks about centering race, she's talking about, like, you know, not, you know, missing the forest for the trees. You know, she's like, you can't tell these stories properly because they're it's almost always part of the story. And yeah, that's it.
So we are at that point where we stop just throwing stuff at you. We've got a half hour built in for questions. I have plenty more, but we'd love to hear from you guys. I think the rules were told to me that SCJ members get priority, and I think journalists get priority. That's my own rule. No, just kidding. I think that's a thing. So if anybody has questions, feel free. Yeah. So to summarize, being told about certain health impacts and being sensitive to it, not making assumptions about it, but still maybe following it through to see if there is a thread there that you should be pulling on, is that?
Yeah, just kind of. I mean, it's one of those things where I can't say for sure that this caused an issue.
Sure.
That's a really hard question. So a lot of the work that frontline groups do is education. So we do our best to push information out there. The more information that you can write about, and maybe before you write a story where you have to go in and interview people, you write a story about statistics that you found, something like, this law passed in Pennsylvania, you know, and then go in and write a follow-up story about this is the response that people are having. Because, you know, in my day-to-day, it is very difficult to push information out there and not get any kind of feedback, like negative feedback from it from people in the community. So, like, for example, we wrote a blog post about CONSOL Energy laying off workers recently. And then the people who were laid off were the only ones commenting on our Facebook page. So getting that information out there, like the facts, like, no, actually they said in hearing that they didn't have to lay people off. This is a choice that they made. So that's a story in and of itself. And then asking people, again, like I said, then getting more feedback from the actual community members is a different story. It's a longer process, and that might not be something that your editor would necessarily want to run. I don't really know, but
you can educate first and then come back.
Yeah, that's helpful, and that's actually something that, as much as I can be a resource for you to get you sources, you could definitely be a resource for me to get information from people that I may not know. You might have talked to a professor who's done research on a lot of things that I've never heard of before, but you can make that connection for me, and I would really love you for it.
A little bit's what we were talking about earlier, too. I think there's a lot of power in painting, again, with word counts and time and resources, you know, infinite. But painting a picture of this person's life in this community and not just focusing on the air pollution and the COPD, but getting a real clear sense of the struggles that this person in this community is going through. Because I just think there's a lot of power in that community profile, and not just focusing on these two things that may or may not be linked, but the fact that there's a whole host of struggles that a lot of these communities are dealing with, that helps. Any other questions? Good question. Yeah, that was one of mine I had on here. We didn't get to, so thanks for bringing it up. So the question is, if there are sources of data to go and try to tease out environmental justice stories.
I've had mixed luck with sort of county, city, and state level health authorities. They're not always looking at for the same stuff that you are, but you can always. I mean, that's sort of like the first place that I always start, you know, CDC, obviously, for, like, national stuff. And then a lot of times, like, good state public health departments will have a lot of the information you're looking for. And depending on how sophisticated you are and how sophisticated the sort of data operation is where you work. I know it's pretty good where...
it's okay
where
there.
Where Talia works.
They're okay.
but for us... you know, taking like data sets like census data and then marrying it with public health data, that's like a capacity that we're trying to figure out how to get our hands on. But, you know, as we said earlier, well, sometimes that data doesn't exist and that smoking gun doesn't exist and that pattern that you're trying, that you have anecdotes for, the data doesn't exist. But obviously, I mean, data is like sort of the end game for all of this. If you have that and you're describing that and you're interrogating a data set, like you're golden.
I think the toxics release inventory is always kind of a gold mine. Yeah. Talia, I definitely want to hear from you on this, but another, source for me, and it's sort of data, but if you just set up a scholarly search for environmental justice or toxics, a lot of times those health studies are, you see the impacts. I've had a lot of stories that I found that weren't even, these weren't environmental justice studies, they were studies of communities, and they said, well, holy shit, this group over here is disproportionately impacted. And I've kind of backed into a lot of environmental justice stories that way.
Yeah, definitely. I actually have not done a whole lot of data stuff. I know that EJ Screen at EPA is, I have not used it a ton, but it seems like it could be really useful. They marry a lot of the EPA data with demographics and kind of socioeconomic factors. And I was just about to put this young woman from the CDC on the spot, but she's popping out for a second. I was going to ask, I forgot the name of the tool that we talked about yesterday. CDC has one that deals with resilience, or not resilience, I'm sorry, but I'm sorry, what was the name of that tool that we were talking about yesterday?
I'm sorry, the public health tracking?
Yes, public health tracking, the public health tracking tool. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, I apologize. No, you're good. So yeah, so like the CDC has this this tool. I have not used it. I just learned about it last night. But it takes public health information and socioeconomic and census tracking data, and it looks at, you know, mortality, but also looks at, you know, like asthma rates and other things like that. And so a lot of government organizations or government agencies have that data. A lot of the stuff that we end up doing is we end up taking not necessarily stuff that's already been married, but we try to look at what data is available and then marry it with things that we can look at. Kind of the same thing that Brian was saying, like, okay, well, we have this data about, you know, I don't know, well, for the thing that I'm thinking about is not at all economics, but it's like the Title VI data that we created. We said, okay, well, these are all, you know, kind of EJ communities, so let's look and see where do we see, things are really not getting through, where do we see, you know, that these people are really not being listened to. And so just kind of looking and seeing what the data tells you in the same way as you would any story, but instead of just saying, okay, what's the highest, what's the lowest, saying, okay, well, what's the racial component, what's the socioeconomic component, what's, you know, the language component, what are the other lenses that you can look at this same data that you've always been looking at, but look at it through a different lens, and that's all.
Yeah, please.
Sometimes you were talking a little bit about kind of the issues with trying to get some of the underlying data with you know, advocacy groups and things like that. There are sometimes, if that one organization has that data, another organization may have it. They may have gotten it through FOIA. So you can always refoia it from them. Sometimes it may just take several conversations. So I know that we work a lot with, or I have worked a lot, not we as ProPublica, but I, as a reporter, have worked with EIP a lot, Environmental Integrity Project, because they collect a lot of data. And sometimes they are willing to, give that same data to you, because what they care about is getting the story out. And what we did, when I worked at CPI, we got some data from them, and what I did is I went through and I verified every piece of it before we used it. And so it wasn't just like, okay, we're going to take this data whole cloth from you. It was like, all right, we're going to take this data, and then I am going to literally go back through and double check everything to make sure that it's actually accurate and that it's telling the story that we think it's telling. And so that there may be an avenue as well for you.
I don't think this answers particularly the question around underlying data, but in general, these tools can sometimes be really tricky to use too. Like, I know that I've tried using some of the census tools and have struggled. Like when, you know, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, I was particularly curious about the Afro-Latino population there, where they were concentrated, and I was failing miserably at trying to find this online. And I wrote to the census. I got a call back from, you know, one of their data analysts, and he guided me through the whole process online, and it was much simpler than I thought it was. But there's always people willing to, like, talk to you on the phone and guide you through some of these tools, too, and, like, researchers who know where all this data is. I'm a big proponent of just, like, calling people up and being like, I don't know what to do, and tell me how to do it.
If you're new, Environmental Working Group has been really forward providing me data too. But I do the same thing. We go, it was USDA, and I went back through it. But just to have that starting point to have them tell me the trends. Yeah. So how to find a variety of sources and not rely on the sources that everybody else has been quoting and talking to.
One, run the clip search before you go. One thing that I found in is that a lot of the or people who are speaking at press conferences or whatever, they're the ones that advocates have identified as people who can, you know, clearly tell their stories, and they're you know, comfortable speaking. That doesn't mean they're the only people who are impacted. For example, I'm doing right now, there's a certain, you know, kind of circuit of people that end up, you know, kind of running being in all this news stories, and I'm just like, okay, well, I literally do not want to talk to them. Like, I need someone else. And I will just tell them, I'll say, look, do you know anybody else who else is there? Like, I know that you had to vet all these people and you think that you've done me a service and I appreciate that, but give me some of the other people. Like, I don't need them to be camera ready. Like, I just want them to be regular people. And when they understand that you don't necessarily need them to give you sound bites and that you're willing to take the time to just listen to someone who isn't, you know, used to speaking, you know, in 20-second bites, then they're like, oh, of course, I can give you, you know, Sandra. I can give you, you know, whomever. Like, I can give you all these people. That's one avenue. You can also, if you know, if it's a location-based kind of story, and you know that this one person lives in this neighborhood, one, you can obviously go to that neighborhood and knock on doors, or you can use some of the, like a Nexus search, and kind of do the neighbors search and say, okay, well, if you live here and you're having this issue, you might have this issue too, and you might have this issue too. And so kind of going around those people, when I could, or when I was in communities, I would go to a lot of public hearings. So city council meetings, like those are people who are actually engaged. They're not necessarily always the people who are identified as, you know, spokespeople, but they're the people who care and the people who are impacted by some of those things. And so I think it's easy to kind of to get the one person who is great and who is, you know, gives you all the quotes that you need. And sometimes it's like, all right, I know that this person's great. Let me just keep reporting and just let me go and get, you know, these five. Yeah, yes, I will talk to you then. Because it's like you always are at those events and, you know, you get this great person. You're like, oh, my gosh, I can actually leave if I needed to. And you're like, no. Actually talk to those other 6-7 people who are in the room. And then say, okay, then when you get back to your newsroom and you're like, oh man, like she's in everything, you can say, oh great, I got all these other 5 people, get their phone numbers. So that way, even if maybe didn't talk to them for as long, you can say, oh, I can go back and talk to you and say, hey, I had a couple other questions and let me get back to you and get a little bit more from you to help me flesh out this story. And so I know that's a little bit hard to do sometimes on deadline, but when you can, try. And if you can't, then, you know, sometimes you have to go with the person who's been quoted a million times. But if you can, just try and do that a little bit extra and, you know, kind of find someone else. Sorry.
I actually always talk to the people that are in the clip file, usually, because then during the course of my conversation, I'll be like, has anybody else, you know, had a similar situation? And, oh, you know, oftentimes organically they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, the house across the street, like so and so, this happened to them. And I'll be like, oh great, could I like talk to them, can you give me their contact? And so a lot of times the people who have been interviewed sort of become like sort of de facto Sarah. De facto Sarah's, like they've done the sort of like first round of, you know, press for that community, and then you can sort of drill a little deeper.
There was a woman in the back that I missed earlier. I wanted to make sure. Yeah. So in EJ's story, is making sure that we include the economic impacts, the social, political, all the other ramifications around just the community. I know I shortened it. They all heard you. I'll start real quick. You guys, go ahead. Go ahead. Whoever.
I think that is actually what we focus on usually. We're telling a community story, but we're also saying, here's why. This is happening because otherwise, if you're just coming in and saying, you know, oh, woe is this community, woe, you know, whatever, that's not a service. At least at ProPublica, what we try to do is we try to tell stories with moral force, and we try to tell stories that can create some sort of change. And if you can't actually identify a harm, and if you can't identify some sort of fault line, then it's very hard to say, yes, this story will create change if you can't figure out, you know, where the system is broken. And so we do a lot of saying, okay, you know what, this regulation is leaving this entire segment of industry unregulated, and therefore it has this impact on people. And so you always are tying it in, and that's telling a part. That's a part of telling the story of that community and saying it's not just that, oh, this community chose to be polluted. It's no. There are all these different factors that led to this community being disproportionately impacted.
There's also I did a story on and continue to do a story on a mine in Western Michigan too that a Wisconsin tribe is they don't want it for obvious reasons, and you know, part of that story though for this community is a lot of people do want it. They don't have jobs up there. I live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and it's poor everywhere. And I'm not saying that's a reason, but it's my job to point out the fact that, well, there is a little bit of economic windfall, and the other part of that is the reason there's a mine is because all of us have phones and computers, and these metals are all of a sudden in demand. So that mine has to go somewhere, so maybe the Menominee tribe, you know, I told their story, and maybe they don't deserve it, but does a poor community in China deserve it? I mean, it's going to go somewhere. And I think getting that point across, especially for those types of stories, is really important.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency to think of EJ stories as sort of starting at the point of protests or community organizing or that kind of event. But usually there is a economic decision, an engineering decision, a governmental decision, or a series of those that has taken place that has gotten you to that situation that caught your eye. And, you know, you can't really tell these stories without getting that story straight. Because that's sort of how you stop this from happening subsequently.
Yeah, and one more quick point is context. You know, the story I mentioned, to just talk about the economics and the tribe is an oversimplification because there was a termination attempt. They were kicked off their ancestral homeland. So, you know, you provide all that context and the reader kind of says, well, geez, this is a justice issue. So you had a question, I think? Yeah. So different ways to contact sources outside of just calling and emailing.
So I did use a letter. I got this. So if you make comments on any sort of federal rule, it's on regulations.gov, and sometimes they have phone numbers, sometimes they have emails, but they always usually have addresses. And so I literally made a big mail merge, and it was the bane of my existence for a couple hours as I like stuffed envelopes and, you know, added my card. And I got like, you know, I only sent out like maybe 40 letters, but I got maybe 10 calls back. And so it worked out for me in that sense, because I could have done a lot more, and I chose to not do that much more because I was like, nah. I've done that. I haven't used a lot of other, I guess, kind of novel tools, but I know that people have used leaflets or postcards, just kind of like going in communities and dropping things off. When I was a city reporter, I would go to communities and just leave my business card with a note on the back, like kind of really analog. So you can do that. I guess any way that you can, we use Twitter, I use DMs. I do not do this as much as some other reporters do. They'll send out a message and say, hey, you know, I need to talk to you, you know, kind of an at the person or whatever. I don't necessarily like to do that just because then I feel like everybody else knows that I'm trying to talk to this person. But that's a thing that a lot of people do. I've sent messages on Facebook. I will use, basically, if I find someone who has a bunch of modes of communication, I will find every kind of way. So there's like a senator I'm trying to speak, like a state senator. So I found like his local, his personal email, his, you know, work email, his, you know, government email, his contact form on his website, I sent him a DM, I sent him, you know, a Facebook message. You know, I was just like, all right, here's all I've got. Let me try and hopefully something will stick. And you know, and obviously I did call as well. So, but I think it's just like you, the same way you would do anything, any way that you have a piece, a way to communicate with them, then try. And I think that's the other thing. Like Nexus has a bunch of that information. Sometimes it's wrong, and so I will send out, you know, to everybody's, you know, random email addresses, and maybe they get through, and you hope they get through, and sometimes they don't, and then that's when, you know, sometimes the mailing things is sometimes helpful, because one, people don't get mail that often, and they're like, oh, what's this handwritten, you know, note, and I'm like, hey, it's me, come talk to me. And yeah, so I mean, so sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think just like we are such a connected society now that, you know, use the tools that you use. I know that another friend of mine uses, WhatsApp to talk to people. We use Signal, we use all these other things. So just whatever platforms you're already on, probably other people are on too. Like use Facebook. Every group mostly has a Facebook group. Message the group and say, hey, I'm trying to talk to someone, you know, so use all of those methods.
Just piggybacking off of Talia, but social media is the best tool, in my opinion. That's where I've gathered like most of my sources in my reporting when the Dakota Access Pipeline was going on. And I'm in New York, so, and I never got sent over there because I was, you know, working for a very small media outlet. But Facebook was my best friend. I found so many sources on Facebook through groups, through just individuals, and seeing who comments on their posts and who shares their posts. Social media is the best. Hashtags are also very helpful when it comes to Twitter. Like if you're covering a specific topic, if people are really, really, you know, revved up about it, they're probably tweeting with a hashtag. I feel no shame in tweeting at people. I just be like, yo, please call me. I'll like put my phone number there and everything. It's probably a little reckless, but social media is your best friend.
Also, you put your contact information in your profiles. Like, I mean, yeah. My email, and I'm sure most people's emails are reporters, like, you put your email in your bio. Like, if people come to you and are like, oh, who's this person that just added me? Oh, here's my email. Feel free to call me. Do all the things. Like, also keep your DMs open. So sometimes in Twitter, you can only DM people who you're friends with. And sometimes that backfires, obviously, with all the horrible people who are on the internet. But if you keep your DMs open, then anybody that wants to contact you can contact you. And sometimes you can, you know, you can decide whether or not that's a good practice for your own self-care. But, you know, if you're looking for a story, sometimes people will hit you up in that way because it's an easy way. And if they're already seeing you engage on Twitter and they're like, oh, well, let me send you a note. You're like, they don't have to follow you. You don't have to follow them. It's just kind of a very easy way to kind of get people to talk to you.
We probably have time for one more. And everybody, I think they're all up. They'll be around. So if you have any other questions, you know, talk to us. Yeah.
Hi. I'm wondering how your work is affected when there's like suddenly like a huge rush of media attention to an issue, say like Standing Rock, and then it goes away.
So how do you handle a rush of media attention to one specific story or issue? For your own coverage?
Well, if you're covering EJ, you should never just rush in when everyone else is rushing in. If you're doing that, then you're covering it very wrong. And ideally, you've already built a repertoire with these sources and have built you know, real relationships with them, and they'll prefer to talk to you over the other media outlets because they know what to expect with them, and that is that parachuting type journalism, which is not ideal when covering this. But I think if you've been covering it long enough, then you already know more than everyone else does, and you already have an advantage. And it's telling the story that no one else is, and that's up to you to figure that out. But everyone else is likely already going to be telling the same story. And if you know more, then your story is going to be different, it's going to be better, and it's going to be more truthful to the communities.
My strategy is to stick with the story. So sometimes the best stories that you can tell are sort of after the main event. And at that point, these stories are in the public consciousness, but you're able to track sort of the aftermath, that you're able to sort of tell the ending or the end of that chapter. And so the biggest thing that I would say, the lesson that you learn after you've been a reporter for a little while is like, the story keeps going on after everybody leaves. And sometimes the most shocking parts or the most solutions-oriented parts or whatever, those happen later, and everybody misses them.
And we saw this in Flint. You know, the Flint story, there was a lot of attention, and then all of a sudden this flood of stories from around the nation, like Pittsburgh's water is full of lead, everywhere. Same thing with Standing Rock, and we were already in Native communities doing stories when Standing Rock was going on, and we just used it as an opportunity to say, well, yeah, that's really important, but tribal sovereignty is an issue everywhere and has been for a really long time. And Standing Rock was super important, but hey, look over here in Wisconsin and the Puget Sound. So I think Nikhil it's a really good point. Those stories are in your community, they're elsewhere in the nation, and kind of zig when everybody else zags. So we're out of time. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. If you don't read these folks, they're the best. So, you know, check them out and you can learn a lot. Thanks. See ya.